be praying for these kids.
Alison and I have been here for a few months now. We're about to actually head back to where we normally live. So we're taking the very wise step of heading south for winter. Wrong hemisphere, I guess. Anyway, we really appreciate the welcome that you've shown us here. And thanks, Tucker, even having endured one of my classes, that you're willing to have me come and share with everyone here. So thank you for that. So this morning, we're going to be looking at Psalm 104, as you can see from the screen. I thought I might start. The text won't come up on the screen just yet. It will come up as I go through it. But I thought I'd start just by reading it, that you might hear from the Word of God and to allow God to speak to you as you hear from the Scriptures. So Psalm 104 goes like this. Bless Yahweh, my soul. Yahweh, my God, you are very great. You're clothed with splendor and majesty. Yahweh, the Lord, wraps himself in light as with a garment. He stretches out the heavens like a tent and lays the beams of his upper chambers on their waters. He makes the clouds his chariot and rides on the wings of the wind. He makes winds his messengers, flames of fire his servants. He set the earth on its foundations. It can never be moved. You covered it with the watery depths as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke, the waters fled. At the sound of your thunder, they took to flight. They flowed over the mountains. They went down into the valleys to the place you assigned for them. You set a boundary they can't cross. Never again will they cover the earth. He makes springs pour water into the ravines. It flows between the mountains. They give water to all the beasts of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. The birds of the sky nest by the waters. They sing among the branches. He waters the mountains from his upper chambers. The land is satisfied by the fruit of his work. He makes grass grow for the cattle and plants for people to cultivate, bringing forth food from the earth. Wine that gladdens human hearts, oil to make their faces shine, and bread that sustains their hearts. The trees of Yahweh were watered, the cedars of Lebanon that he planted. There the birds make their nests. The stork has its home in the junipers. The high mountains belong to the wild goats. The crags are a refuge for the hyrax. He made the moon to mark the seasons, and the sun knows when to go down. You bring darkness, it becomes night. And all the beasts of the forest prowl. The lions roar for their prey and seek their food from God. The sun rises and they steal away. They return and lie down in their dens. Then people go out to their work, to their labor until evening. How many are your works, Yahweh? In wisdom you made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. There's a sea. Vast and spacious, teeming with creatures beyond number, living things both small and large. There the ships go to and fro. And Leviathan, which you formed to frolic there. All creatures look to you to give them their food at the proper time. When you give it to them, they gather it up. When you open your hand, they're satisfied with good things. When you hide your face, they are terrified. When you take away their breath, they die and return to the dust. When you send your spirit, they're created and you renew the face of the ground. May the glory of Yahweh endure forever. May Yahweh rejoice in his works. He who looks at the earth and it trembles, who touches the mountains and they smoke. I will sing to Yahweh all my life. I will sing praise to my God as long as I live. May my meditation be pleasing to him as I rejoice in Yahweh. But may sinners vanish from the earth and the wicked be no more. Bless Yahweh, my soul. Bless Yahweh. How do you see the world? What, like, I'm old. I need these things. I need glasses in order to see anything that's going on. What are the glasses that you use when you come to look at the world? What shapes the way you see it, the way you experience it? There are a bunch of ways that people imagine the world, the lenses through which they look at it. Part of my background is in the sciences, and many people who work in the sciences see this world as just mechanistic causation. It's just thing after thing after thing. Perhaps in the world as it is now, where we've faced some incredibly disruptive conflict, perhaps this is you see the world as something which is insecure, as dangerous, as out of control, or perhaps in a world where many people are feeling the pressures of the economy, of the cost of living. Perhaps this feels to you like a world of scarcity, where there's not quite enough and you have to fight tooth and nail for your little bit. Maybe for some who've been in the church for a while, you've been taught to see this world as of relatively little significance, of a veil of tears which will pass quickly and is of no real account. What are the glasses through which you look at the world? We're often not aware of them. I've been wearing these things for so long that I often forget that they're on my face until my head hits a pillow and it feels rather awkward. The lenses through which we look at the world not only shape our understanding of the world, they shape our understanding of God, the one who made it. How we see the world matters. It matters for how we understand God. It matters for how we navigate the world. Here's a picture. Some of you may have seen this. It was on the news a month or so ago. This is a picture taken from the Artemis moon trip. Did you see this one? This is moon from the moon, the picture of the sun rising over the Earth and moonlight on it. Pictures like that shape how we see the world. We see it in its entirety. Normally, we see this little bit in front of us, right? A picture like this gives us a cosmic view of the planet we live on. The psalm that I read a few minutes ago gives us not just a cosmic picture, it gives us a bigger picture than this one, because it gives us not a spaceship's view of the world, it gives us a God's eye view of the world, of all creation, of everything that exists. And it tells us that everything we see, everything we endure, everything even we endure in the world is God's work. It's God's handiwork. It's God's ongoing project, something that God cares deeply about and has not left to its own devices. And so if we want to get the right picture of the world, actually we don't even start there. We don't start with what we see around us. We start with God, from whom it came and for whom it all exists. To see the world right, we start with God and with God's glory, God's grandeur. And interestingly, that's where this psalm not only starts, it's where it finishes. So what I want to do this morning is take a little bit of time, not too long. I do have a watch on my wrist. I'll pay attention to it at some point. I just want to work our way through the psalm so you can see what the psalmist is doing in helping us to see the grandeur of God as it's reflected in the light of the world, and see how that shapes and reshapes our view of the world and of the God whose handiwork it is. And so it starts with praise. Actually, the first word of this psalm is bless. It's what the psalmist does to start with is he speaks to himself, calling himself to bless Yahweh. Bless Yahweh, my soul. You can see it up there. I'll leave it there for the moment. You can have a look at that for the time being. It's an interesting opening. This is the only time in the Psalms we have this opening. Bless Yahweh. The NIV, if you've got it, translates it praise, which is a bit of a shame because it's a slightly different word. Bless Yahweh. My soul, myself, my very being. It's an odd thing to do when you think about it, isn't it? To speak to yourself and to tell yourself what to do. You ever thought that's a bit weird? Normally when you're speaking to someone or telling them what to do, you're speaking to someone else. Here the psalmist is speaking to himself. To acknowledge God's goodness and greatness. And that notion of blessing Yahweh, of recognizing who the Lord is, recognizing the goodness and the greatness and the majesty of God, that then shapes everything that flows through the rest of the psalm. And it moves to God's own greatness. We have these interesting images, don't we, of God clothed in glorious light. It's a picture of a king, if you like, sitting in the king's palace, wearing the kind of fancy clothes that rich and important people tend to wear, right? And these fancy clothes that Yahweh, the Lord, wears is the light that the Lord created. Yeah? And then there's this very odd bit. Don't know if you spotted this. Stretches out the heavens like a tent, makes the clouds his chariot. What we've got here is a picture of the world. I'm not sure if this pointer is going to work. Yes, it does. All right. So this is people at the time that the Old Testament was written had a particular understanding of the world. It was kind of like a snow globe, if I can picture it that way. The earth was this flat, stable bit here, and it was surrounded by water. And what this psalm begins by telling us is that the Lord is the sovereign creator of all things. That all this bit, the heavens, Yahweh just went, okay, I'll have one of them, and stretches it out like a tent. Yep. Tucker's weird. He likes camping. I think that's a very strange thing. But anyway, when you go camping, the first thing you do is set up the tent. And if you've got a decent tent, it doesn't take that long. That's what the Lord does at the beginning of creation. It's like God's great camping expedition. The heavens that we look at, this vast expanse of the universe, is like a tent that the Lord sets up. Yeah? This is the glory, the grandeur of God. Rides on the wings of the wind. Now you think, okay, fine. That's actually a picture of God as a conqueror. Because one of the things about this picture of the ancient world was that most people at that time felt that the world was always under threat from chaos. That any moment this kind of bubble could burst. And the waters of chaos would come and flood the world again. Yeah? What we have here is a picture of the Lord as the one who holds chaos at bay and, in fact, who rules over it. So much so that those pictures of incredible power which in other religions were seen as the domain of the other gods, like there were storm gods and all that kind of stuff, right? The Lord is the one who rides on the wings of the wind. You think about that for a moment. I was up here last year when the cyclone didn't hit, or at least a few days before the cyclone didn't hit, and you can remember that. But you remember, even though the cyclone did not hit, the winds were something fierce, were they not? There, Yahweh just kind of cruises along in that unimaginable power. The picture we have here, the picture that these opening verses give us, is of a God who is far above all we can imagine. Now, the fancy term for this is transcendence. It's another way of speaking of the holiness that Tucker was speaking of earlier, the otherness of God. One of the ways in which God is different to everything else that exists is that God is far above everything that exists. God is more glorious than we can imagine or say. Even these soaring words of poetry only touch the hem of God's cloak. It may seem initially as if such a glorious God is too high and mighty and holy to soil God's hands with this world, this planet that we spin on. Of course not. This is the God who called all things into being, who gets God's hands dirty, so to speak, in the making of the world, which is what the next section of the psalm moves on to. Again, it speaks of the imagery that it uses goes back to this picture of the world. He set the earth on its foundations. That's this bit, right? In the midst of the threatening chaos, the world that God has made is firm and secure. Yes? The picture that we have is of these waters initially. They were kind of flooding everything. And what God does is push them back. Yeah? To make a space for other creatures, for creatures like us to inhabit. Now, we're used to the language of Genesis 1 and John 1, of God bringing everything into being by God's word of power, yes? That's good and important language. This is another way of speaking of it. It's speaking of God as the one who is the victorious Lord over everything that threatens the integrity of what God has made. If there are forces at work to undermine the orderliness of this world, God is the one who holds them always at bay. But the way in which this is imagined in this psalm is that this creation is all about water. God works with that picture and transforms it. Here, the picture of creation, I spoke earlier about God getting God's hands dirty in making the world. In this picture, actually, God's hands not so much dirty as very, very wet. And what we see as the psalm goes on is that the water, which in people's, in the imagination of the ancient world, this water was always threatening the orderliness of the world that people inhabited. Yep? That was just the picture that people had in their heads. That water now is tamed for God's purposes. Now, this doesn't strike us quite as powerfully as it would have for the ancient readers or hearers of this psalm. The water that God tames in creation now uses to provide for God's creatures. A friend of mine pointed this out to me. when you read this psalm, one of the things you need to do is watch the water. Follow the water and where it goes. Yeah? And here we see that this water now flows at God's command. Yes? It flows to give water to all creatures. Notice who God provides for. Yeah? We sometimes focus too much on ourselves, don't we? Yes? That we think that everything is about us. Yeah, not so much. Look at it. God, is this thing working? My little light's not going. The beasts of the field, wild animals, wild donkeys. Yes? God provides for them, the birds. Yes? All the land is satisfied by what God does. This picture starts in the mountains. Now, this particular picture is taken from Lura Cascades. Alison and I lived up there in the Blue Mountains west of Sydney, that little town that's a little bit south of here. So we lived near here, and we would often walk through the mountains. If you get to Sydney, go to the Blue Mountains. Spectacular. And this is a walk that we would often do, following these waters down into the valley. Yes? The waters start here in the mountains and the creeks that flow from springs and rain. And God provides for the birds and for the trees in which they nest. Yes? But God also cares for us. The stuff that matters to us, grass growing for the cattle. Cattle, we know cattle. We know what they're there for, yes? They're there in order to work. They're there in order to provide milk, to provide meat. This is speaking about animals that now provide for humans and our affairs. And the plants that we cultivate, yes? And it's worth noting, by the way, that God provides humans not just with the stuff that we need, yes? The food that sustains our hearts. But, Baptist Church, though I know it is, wine that gladdens a human heart, the luxuries of life. Yes? God is not a miserly God. God's not a God who kind of reluctantly gives little bits and pieces, only the stuff that you barely need for survival. This is a God who gives us the stuff which brings us joy. Oil to make our faces shine. Well, I probably wouldn't use oil that way, but nonetheless, you get the picture, don't you? This is about the God who provides sustenance, the things that we need, but also who provides us with delight. Yeah? How different that is to the picture of the world we often have, where we think that we have to scrabble for existence, that we have to fight for every bit to come our way. Now, some of the ways we've ordered the world mean that that's sometimes all too true. But God has bountifully provided more than we need. It'd be interesting to think about how our lives might come to reflect that same kind of generosity in how we use what God has entrusted to us. Let's think about this just a little bit more. Think about the kind of provision that we see here. So, this is one of Alison's favourite creatures in the world. This is a thing called a hyrax. You've probably never heard of them except in the Bible, also called rock badgers. They're these weird little creatures. We saw some. We had the opportunity years ago to go to Palestine and Jordan and Israel, and around the Sea of Galilee you find these creatures actually fighting off cats. They're really weird little things. You know, God provides for weird little creatures like hyraxes. Yes? That's the extent of the provision of God and of all the complex systems of life that sustain them. systems of cooperation and competition. Every ecosystem we see is all the work of God's hand. Each leaf is imprinted with God's fingerprints. Each meal a gift of God's grace, even for funny little critters like the hyrax. So when at night you hear bats shrieking in the fig trees, or in the morning you see fish leap in the river, or you have the great privilege of seeing a native bee helicoptering between flowers, you see the open hand of God who provides for all God's creatures. But God also provides the stuff that we need for our endeavours, for the stuff that we get about in the world. The food we grow and then process and transport across vast distances, all of that also is a provision of God. The systems that allow for it, the ores, the energy, the minerals that you need to build complex machines like tractors, the energy that you need to transport it from one place to another, even the systems of roads, the economy, all of that is under the good care of God. All of that is part of God's provision. The very stability we enjoy most of the time that allows us to make these complex systems that allow a city like Brisbane to survive, that is a gift of God. A sign of God's goodness and grandeur. So when you enjoy your breakfast, whether that's hot buttered toast or masala dosa, you eat from the open hand of a generous God. But more than that, when you're involved in the provision for others, when you plant a tree or water a garden, you are a finger of God's good hand in the world. When you bake bread, or drive a truck or a cab, you are a finger of God's good hand at work in the world. When you try and understand this world, because it's a rich and complex world, and some of us are gifted with the job of trying to make sense of it. We explore complex genetics or cell physiology, or figure out how ecosystems work, or how the human mind works, and how to help when it doesn't work so well. Whenever you're involved in something like that, you are mapping the fingerprints of God. See, God not only summoned the world into existence, but cares for it and the creatures that inhabit it, and cares for them moment by moment. God not only summoned us into existence, but cares for us moment by moment. And we, as those who recognize that this is the world of God, we get to bear witness to it and even participate in that great work of God. Follow the water, see where it goes. But then there's this odd interruption in the psalm. We suddenly go from space, because we start off in the mountains, flowing down into the world of animals and human affairs, and then suddenly we're speaking of time. It's an interesting interruption of the flow of water through the psalm. It takes us back to the heavens and returns to the earth that they govern. He speaks of the moon, and again, in the world that the psalmist inhabited, many people thought that the sun and the moon were gods, right? I mean, if you think about it, they're great big things in the sky, and if you think about the sun, everyone's aware that life depends on the sun, yes? It's pretty obvious, right? And so lots of ancient people would worship the sun and the moon and the stars as gods, yeah? No. Not here, notice. God made the sun, the moon to mark the seasons. That takes us back to Genesis 1, right? And the sun gets its instructions from God. Yeah? That's how it knows when to get up, go down. That's how it knows whether this is light to shed light onto the world of human affairs or night when other creatures roam and rule. It's interesting to think about time for a moment. Again, we tend to have a kind of miserly view of time. We often think not just that the world is a world of scarcity, but we never have enough time. And so we dole it out in little increments. We guard our time. We use our time. We waste our time. Here, time itself, in all its comforting regularity, is a gift of the God whose generosity is so clear in what God has made and how God governs it. Time itself is a gift from our loving God to us. I wonder if that might change how we see our time, the ways in which we can enjoy our time, as well, yes, as recognizing that there are responsibilities that come with this, as with every other gift. And that time allows is what allows for the regularity of work, but also the gift of rest. Anyway, after that little interruption, we go back to the water, and now we follow the water to where it all ends up, eventually, in the ocean, the sea. How many are your works, Lord Yahweh? In wisdom you made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. Now, this is an interesting thing for someone in Israel to say because they did not like the ocean. One of the things I love is to spend time in the ocean. I like body surfing. So for me, the ocean is a place to enjoy. For Israel, it was a dangerous place. It was a place where you took your life in your hands. If you went on one of these ships, chances were you weren't coming back. Yeah? But that ocean, that often dark and dangerous place, and I think we've all seen the ocean as it rages, that too is God's creation. This great, wide, deep ocean, the place to which all rivers run, is another creation of God and subject to God's sovereign care. Even Leviathan. We don't know what Leviathan was. You can see it in Job. Some people think a crocodile. Here, I think probably a whale. I mean, think about whales. I've never got up close to whales. People who have are struck by just how enormous they are. Yeah? And they do that. They leap and play these enormous things. These things over which, really, particularly ancient humans had no control. They're kind of like the playthings of God. See, God doesn't just make the world. God enjoys the world, yes? Leviathan is there to play in the oceans, yeah? This thing of absolute massive power is Yahweh's little watery pet. God's power, God's grandeur, is reflected in all we experience, including things that really are outside our interest and control. Do you notice that? There are the wild goats and the wild donkeys and the hyraxes and the birds that nest up in the mountains. They're not part of our world. They're part of God's world. And they're things that God cares for. Whereas the waters reach their end in the ocean, the psalm doesn't quite finish there. It presents this picture of a God who is intimately involved in every moment from life to death. God knows that we are dust. God remembers our frame. Every breath of life we have is a gift from God. And even in our end, when we die, we are still in the hands of the loving God who made us. God is no absent landlord. We often have that picture of a God who is so transcendent that the little bits and pieces of our lives don't really matter to God. That's not what this psalm tells us. It's kind of comforting but terrifying at the same time, isn't it? To recognise that every breath we take, when I go, that is utterly dependent on God's good gift of breath and of the muscles that allow me to breathe it in and breathe it out. We are not our own. Not only were we bought with a price, we were made by the God of the universe, and every breath we take is a gift of God's grace. And even when we end, do you notice? Even when we end, God's work of creation continues. That's humbling, isn't it? But that too prompts us to praise. And that's where the psalm takes us in the end. Notice everything is in the hand of God. And it leads us back to where the psalm began, kind of. Here is this little, odd little bit. There we go. May sinners vanish from the earth. Did you notice that when I was reading it earlier? It's a little odd interruption here, isn't it? It seems to come out of nowhere. Because what we see in the rest of the psalm is this beautiful portrait of a world which is under God's loving care. And then we have this reference to sinners and the wicked coming to an end. If you think about it for a moment, this reminds us that there is one blot on the glorious picture of the world that we see. And that blot is not the work of God's hands, but of ours. And so what this psalm is reminding us of is a deep yearning that we find in our hearts, I think. A deep yearning that having experienced the goodness of God in space and time, in provision, in creation, in all that we have celebrated, this yearning that this dark smear on the landscape that we see, this splinter that gets in our hands whenever we touch anything, that someday that might be drawn, that blot might be erased, that the only darkness we see is the darkness of the gift of light, not the darkness of sin and its destruction. It's that kind of yearning, I think, that Paul picks up on, isn't it, in Romans 8, where Paul reminds us that yearning is not just ours, but the creation itself longs for the liberty of the children of God. Yes? But in the end, we bless Yahweh and praise the Lord for all of God's goodness. And we know that yearning that blot might be wiped from the face of creation is a yearning that God will answer. And so I invite you to join with the psalmist in seeing the world like this. Seeing the world as the work of the God of grandeur and grace. A world in which God invites us to participate in God's provision for others. God invites us to participate in working God's good order in the world. a world in which we long to see God's glory and only God's glory in view. Shall we pray? Our Lord and God, we have been singing of your awesome wonder, of the riches of your creative work, of the depth of your love for us as creatures. And we want to continue to sing and to give you the glory that is rightly your due. And we ask that as we sing, you might help us to see the world through your eyes, to see it through the lens of your glory and grandeur, that we might come to experience the world afresh as your magnificent and glorious and good creation, as your rich and plentiful gift, that we might receive that with wonder and delight and seek to reflect something of your glory and of your generosity in the lives we live to the praise of your glory. Do that, please, for Christ's sake.